From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, January 17th. Nearly 100 Brightline workers voted this week to join a union by a 2-to-1 margin. The onboard attendants will be represented by the Transport Workers Union. Brightline, which operates the Orlando to Miami passenger rail service, hired union busting law firm Littler Mendelson, had its president, according to the union, call workers at home, and argued to the National Mediation Board that it is not a railroad. Brightline is also building a high-speed rail connection from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. Governor Ron DeSantis yesterday named Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody to take the U.S. Senate seat Marco Rubio is leaving when he assumes his new job of Secretary of State. Moody was elected Attorney General in 2018 and re-elected in 2022. Moody has been a loyal ally of DeSantis in office, consistently backing his efforts to crack down on illegal immigration and suing over many of President Joe Biden's initiatives on issues such as immigration, transgender discrimination, and student loan forgiveness. During an appearance in Orlando, DeSantis said Republicans need to take action on illegal immigration and cannot squander this opportunity after the Republicans took control of both houses of Congress. The Florida State Guard will ask the legislature in the upcoming session to pay for medics and additional aircraft. 3 years ago, Ron DeSantis revived the State Guard, which was activated during World War II. Initially, he argued it would help the Florida National Guard during emergencies, but DeSantis last year sent State Guard members to Texas to help with border operations. He might also use it to help with immigration enforcement in the state. Michael Flynn has filed an appeal with the Florida Supreme Court to hear his defamation case against Rick Wilson, the former Florida Republican strategist and prominent Donald Trump critic. The former national security advisor, who was convicted of lying to FBI investigators about connections to Russia, had sued Wilson in Sarasota County Court for defamation over a tweet that called him a Putin employee and a retweet that said, FYI, Mike Flynn is Q. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday.
Listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. This is the final show before the inauguration of the president-elect and what could be the beginning of the end, according to warnings from two very different corners of political commentary. In his farewell address, President Joe Biden pointed to the danger presented by the tech industrial complex to all Americans, led by first pal Elon Musk, who will, according to recent reports, have an office in the White House. Meanwhile, right-wing bomb thrower and longtime Trump acolyte Steve Bannon has vowed to take this guy down, accusing billionaire Musk of only being in it to become a trillionaire. But surely the very transactional president-elect will not forget the $250 million he contributed to the campaign. That just might earn an inaugural ball appearance of a Captain and Tennille cover band crooning the iconic tune Muskrat Love. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear my interview with Ernesto Ruiz, Resource Coordinator at Farm Workers Association of Florida, who will break down some of the anticipated problems for that group should the promises made by the president-elect become promises kept. But first, hear how Meta is now not only fact-checking speech, but encouraging hate speech against those in the LGBTQ community. Meta's new community standards on hateful content give explicit permission for users to refer to people as mentally ill based on their sexual orientation or gender. Homosexuality is not to be considered a mental illness by the American Psychiatric Association since it was removed from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders in 1973. Similarly, being transgender is no longer considered a mental illness or disorder by most major American medical organizations and the World Health Organization. Alongside the announcement that Meta was ending its relationship with independent fact-checkers, the social media company outlined new hateful conduct policies. Those policies explicitly permit users to call LGBTQ plus people mentally ill or abnormal without violating platform rules. These changes are part of a larger shift in how Meta plans to moderate content and speech on its platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. But these carve-outs could also allow the spread of misinformation. Leading medical experts do not consider being gay or transgender to be a mental illness, and with fact-check claims to the contrary. For people who identify as transgender, their sex, their biological category they were assigned at birth, does not match their gender identity, which is someone's internal sense of being a man, woman, or non-binary gender. CEO Mark Zuckerberg said in a January 7th video, "We're going to simplify our content policies and get rid of a bunch of restrictions on topics like immigration and gender that are just out of touch with the mainstream discourse." Meta has long had community standards for the control content allowed on its platform. Meta can take down posts that violate those standards. When it updated standards on hateful conduct on January 7th to narrow what speech violated its policies, Meta specified that insults about mental characteristics, including but not limited to allegations of stupidity, intellectual capacity, and mental illness, are not allowed. That's similar to previous rules, but it added a new exception. We do allow allegations of mental illness or abnormality when based on gender or sexual orientation, given political and religious discourse about transgenderism and homosexuality. The Anti-Defamation League, a non-governmental organization that tracks online extremism, says the term transgenderism has been co-opted by anti-trans activists to characterize being transgender as an ideology rather than an innate identity. In its updated policy rationale, Meta wrote that although people may use insulting language or call for exclusion when discussing topics such as transgender rights or homosexuality, our policies are designed to allow room for these types of speech. Although referring to LGBTQ plus people as mentally ill is now allowed on Meta's platform, that does not make it true or reflective of mainstream medical consensus. Research suggests that higher rates of mental health struggles among LGBTQ people may be attributed to the social stigma and discrimination they experience. Rolling back rights of the LGBTQ plus community seems to be the order of the day. Just over a week left in Joe Biden's presidency, a federal judge scrapped one of his signature education policies. U.S. District Judge Danny C. Reeves, a chief jurist for the Eastern District of Kentucky, ruled last week that the administration's rewrite of Title IX violated the Constitution. The 1972 law prohibits sex-based discrimination in K-12 schools and colleges that receive federal funding. However, the Federal Education Department's interpretation of what constitutes discrimination based on sex was too broad, Reeves wrote, and the rules violated the First Amendment. The decision dealt a fatal blow to the regulations that had come under nationwide scrutiny from Republican politicians because of their explicit protections for queer and transgender students. It's one of many pieces of Biden's education agenda that faced insurmountable opposition or abandonment in the waning weeks of his term. The revised policies, which took years to finalize, expanded the criteria for sex-based discrimination to include gender identity. They also bolstered the rights of students who allege sexual harassment and assault, reversing Trump-era protocols that advocates had criticized because they made it harder for victims to prove their cases. The rules took effect in August, but only for some educational programs. A slew of lawsuits prompted court orders and halted them in a patchwork of states, school districts, and colleges. The regulatory whiplash confused officials at institutions around the country who worried about whether they were in compliance with federal law. It's a very fluid legal environment. Catherine Lehman, the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the Department of Education, told school administrators the day the rules took effect. To be clear, we plan to enforce the 2024 regulations starting today, except where they are enjoined. Those instructions from Lehman now are moot, and conservatives are rejoicing. All of America is now safe from Biden's attempt to undermine half a century of landmark protections for women. Jason Minars, Virginia GOP Attorney General, said in a post on X. Virginia was among the plaintiffs in the lawsuit that spurred Thursday's court order. Opponents of the Biden rules have said that expanding civil rights protections beyond the basis of biological sex would negatively affect women and girls. Supporters say they added a much-needed shield for LGBTQ+ students who face disproportionate harassment. This essentially hands them a ruling that they're not going to contest, said Neil Hutchins, an education professor at the University of Kentucky, referring to the incoming Trump administration. Eliminating DEI policies at McDonald's wasn't enough anti-woke for some. A group opposed to affirmative action filed a lawsuit accusing McDonald's of not going far enough when it recently rolled back several diversity initiatives by continuing to maintain a program that awards scholarships to Latino and Hispanic students. American Alliance for Equal Rights, a group founded by affirmative action foe Edward Blum, and a lawsuit filed on Sunday in federal court in Nashville, alleged the decades-old scholarship program unlawfully discriminates against students from other ethnic groups. Since its launch in 1990 and 1985, McDonald's said its Hassier National Scholarship Program has awarded more than $33 million in college scholarships to Hispanic and Latino students. Up to 30 students annually receive up to $100,000 through the program. Bloom's group says that by restricting eligibility to students who have at least one parent of Hispanic or Latino heritage, the program discriminates against other students, including one of the group's members, a white high school student in Arkansas. The lawsuit alleges that the program violates Section 1981 of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, a Civil War-era law that bars racial bias and contracting, and asks a judge to issue an injunction blocking McDonald's from considering the race and ethnicity of scholarship applicants. It is our hope McDonald's immediately pauses this scholarship program so it can be open to all undersourced high school students, regardless of their ethnic heritage. McDonald's, in a statement, said that it was reviewing the complaint. It added that part of its announcement last week about changes to its diversity initiatives, it was reviewing programs to ensure they align with our vision moving forward. The Chicago-based company on January 6th announced it was retiring its goal for diversity in corporate leadership and shifting away from some diversity practices, citing a shifting legal landscape in the United States. Other companies, including Walmart, have similarly been backing away from diversity practices following pressure from conservative activists. McDonald cited the ruling last year by the conservative majority U.S. Supreme Court that barred the consideration of race as a factor in college admissions. That decision came in lawsuits successfully pursued by a different group founded by Bloom. But Bloom's American Alliance for Equal Rights and others have since that decision pursued a series of cases challenging corporate diversity initiatives. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. A rise in whooping cough cases offers a warning of things to come if anti-vaxxer RFK Jr. is put in charge of health policy. The number of whooping cough cases in Florida soared in 2024. From January 1, 2024 to December 31, 2024, the Florida Department of Health reported 715 cases of pertussis, an eightfold increase over the year before, which had 85 cases. Following a nationwide trend, incidences of pertussis, commonly known as whooping cough, have been increasing to pre-pandemic levels. But in 2024, in Florida, the number of cases was still almost double that of 2019, which recorded 359 cases. The preventative measures used to combat COVID-19, like masks and social distancing, also stopped other respiratory viruses like pertussis, says Jenny Shapiro, a professor specializing in epidemiology at the University of Florida's College of Public Health and Health Professions. Those measures are now gone, coupled with a vaccination rate in Florida that doesn't hit herd immunity. That's why the number of pertussis cases is on the rise in the state. The age group with the most pertussis cases in 2024 was children up to 4 years old. Whooping cough, also known as pertussis, is an infection caused by a type of bacteria called Bordetella pertussis. Babies and small children are particularly vulnerable and may experience apnea or pauses in breathing, pneumonia, seizures, and brain damage, leading to death. Last October, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported more than five times as many whooping cough cases in the country than the year before. While one COVID-infected person usually infects about two people, with pertussis, one infected person can spread the bacteria to as many as 15 people with no immunity. We have pockets of community members that have very low vaccination rates, Shapiro said. If pertussis makes its way into one of those communities that has low vaccination rates, we are much more likely to see an outbreak occur in that population group. Currently in Florida, the vaccination rate for those who have completed all five doses of the Tdap vaccine, which prevents tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, is about 88.1%, Shapiro said. Herd immunity for pertussis requires 92% to 94%. We don't have the high enough levels to prevent community transmission, Shapiro said. A request for comment from DOH is still pending. The illness is called whooping cough because the bacteria produces a toxin that causes inflammation in the respiratory tract and paralysis of the larynx or voice box, which can make it difficult to cough. The person cannot breathe until the larynx relaxes, Shapiro said, and the inhalation is what causes that whoop sound. So it's cough, 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 and when you hear the patient as they're trying to breathe back in, that's where the term whoop comes from, Shapiro said. If you've ever seen someone who's had it and you watch them and they can't breathe, it is scary. Florida requires children entering a public school in kindergarten through 12th grade to have at least 4 doses of the Tdap vaccine, though the state does allow for religious exemptions if immunizations are in conflict with religious tenets and practices of the child's patient or parent or guardian, according to the state health department. Medical providers say vaccine hesitancy has contributed to the rising number of cases of pertussis and other diseases like measles. Especially since the COVID-19 pandemic, state officials like Governor Ron DeSantis and Dr. Joseph Latipo, the state's Surgeon General, have supported messaging that some doctors say contains misinformation about mRNA vaccines. According to the Florida Department of Health report for July 2024, the proportion of children 5 through 17 with new religious exemptions are increasing each month. St. John's, Flagler, Sarasota, and Walton counties have the highest number of children with religious exemptions, according to that data. History will view Trump as a historic president for a number of reasons. Not all very inspiring. Come Inauguration Day, President-elect Donald Trump will become not just the first American president to be a convicted felon, he'll also be the first to make money from his own swearing in. That's because the Donald J. Trump Revocable Trust is the 100% owner of the Florida company that sold the rights to Trump's name, likeness, and image to online company that is hawking the Inauguration Day edition God Bless the USA Bible. I am proud to endorse and encourage you to get this Bible, says Trump in an accompanying video. We must make America pray again. The Inauguration Day Bible, the trusted King James Version, which includes copies of the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Pledge of Allegiance, can be yours for $69.99 plus shipping. Or you can buy now and pay later with 4 interest-free payments of $17.50 every 2 weeks. A God Bless the USA gift bag can be added. Available for a limited time only. Orders for this edition will be available until January 19th, 2025, says the website, GodBlessTheUSABible.com. As an added bonus, every order will receive a free copy of an All-Star Salute to Lee Greenwood DVD. Frequently asked questions on the seller's website identify the company that was paid an undisclosed sum for the rights to market Trump's Holy Bible as CIC Ventures LLC. CIC, apparently, short for Commander in Chief. Ventures was incorporated in Delaware in February 2021 and registered in Florida 3 months later. One thing not addressed in those FAQs were where the Bibles came from. In October, the Associated Press tracked down global trade records and reported that nearly 120,000 copies of the God Bless the USA Bible were printed in China and shipped to the U.S. in 2024 by New Aid Cultural Media, a printing company in Haizong. The Bibles were received by Freedom Park Design, a Florida company incorporated last month by Jared and Ashley Taylor of Gulf Shore, Alabama. The estimated value of the 3 separate shipments was $342,000 or less than $3 per Bible, the AP reported. And when AP reporter called Freedom Park Design to ask about the Bibles, Ashley Taylor hung up. Trump has repeatedly lashed out at China, blaming it for the COVID-19 pandemic and taking jobs away from American workers. In his first term, he began a trade war with China by applying tariffs that the Council on Foreign Relations has said now average about 18% on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Chinese goods. He has recently threatened to triple that. While Trump's federal financial disclosure forms in 2023 and 2024 list him as CIA Ventures LLC's manager, president, secretary, and treasurer, his name does not appear on any state corporate records. Florida corporate records, however, listed 2 original managers, Nicholas Luna of North Miami and John B. Marion IV, a West Palm Beach lawyer. You may recall Luna was a White House aide to President Trump, who also served as his so-called body man in 2020. Politico has reported that Luna, who testified before the January 6th U.S. House Committee, was one of two Trump assistants responsible for overseeing the pack-up of the Oval Office records as Trump's four-year term was ending. Luna is married to former Trump aide Cassidy Dumbolt Luna, who more recently has worked as chief of staff to Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, at Affinity Partners, the Sunny Isles private equity firm that is managing Saudi Arabia's $2 billion investment. How is it Governor DeSantis ever knows what his appointees have said? And apparently, doesn't care. Governor Ron DeSantis defended his appointment to the University of West Florida Board of Trustees of a political scientist who claims that encouraging women to prioritize their careers has led to the decline of family life. In speeches, essays, articles, and interviews, Scott Yenner details his views against same-sex relationships, including that LGBTQ practices bring dreaded diseases, and labeling career-oriented women as medicated, meddlesome, and quarrelsome. But DeSantis claimed during the press conference last week that he wasn't familiar with Yenner's views that women should put motherhood first, which first garnered criticism for after his remarks at the National Conservatism Conference in 2021 and has since repeated in other writings and interviews. I am not familiar with that. I mean, obviously, I think if you look at the state of Florida, we probably have a higher percentage of women enrolled in our state universities than we have men. And that's probably grown under my tenure, DeSantis said during the Jacksonville press conference, in which he talked about the results of his education policy. But what I don't do, what I don't like, is cherry-picking somebody saying this and then trying to smear them. Democratic Senator Lori Berman of Palm Beach County called Yenner's opinions troubling and said nominating someone like Yenner to the board was counterproductive. I find the whole thing shocking, she said. I think it's a throwback to an age that is in the past and belongs in the past. We have seen that women have been part of the workforce now for many, many years, and it's been very successful. We've had women advance in business and politics and nonprofits and education and all of these careers because they went to college. Most notably, Yenner is a political science professor at Boise State University and was a fellow at the conservative think tanks such as Heritage Foundation and the Claremont Institute Center for American Way of Life. In a 2023 interview with First Things podcast published by a journal of religion and public life of the same name, Yenner described how honor and shame were the most effective tools to deal with declining birth and marriage rates. But what effect of large number of single, never married females and childless females are going to have on our politics, on our regime, on our political culture is something that, because it's historically unprecedented, it's something that we don't really have a great grasp on, Yenner said in that interview. The governor's office announced DeSantis tapped Yenner and four others to the UWF board this week. The University in Pensacola has 14,300 students and 2,400 faculty and staff, according to its website. The board has 13 members, and the Florida Senate must confirm all appointments. You can have people get appointed who have flagrant left-wing backgrounds, and that's just swept under the rug, DeSantis said. You never hear legacy media trying to highlight any of that. So I don't play those games. The proof is going to be in the pudding about what they're willing to do. DeSantis also said during the press conference that there would be changes coming to UWF, referring to the institution as highly politicized. The shakeup of the board mirrors the governor's overhaul 2 weeks ago of the board, 2 years ago, of the board of New College of Florida in Sarasota. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next, is my interview with Ernesto Ruiz.
I'm Lou Varanian. I'm happy to welcome Ernesto Ruiz, Research Coordinator at the Farm Worker Association of Florida, whose longstanding mission is to build power among farm worker and rural low-income communities to respond to and gain control over social, political, economic, workplace, health, and environmental justice issues that impact their lives. Hey, Ernesto, how you doing? Thanks for coming on.
I'm good, Lou. Thank you so much. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, just, you know, tell us, you know, a little bit about yourself and how you came to work with FAWAF.
Yeah, thank you. Sure. So I am an anthropologist and public health researcher by training, and I spent most of my professional career studying health disparities. I dabbled a little bit in the tech sector here and there, but felt the calling to come back to do research, which I think is impactful on a social social and ethical level. And I was lucky to come across the Farm Worker Association of Florida last year. Interestingly enough, my dissertation research was with farm workers in rural Costa Rica, so it felt really full circle to come back and to be working to help address the harsh conditions in which our farm working communities and other communities of low income that they face on a daily basis.
Yeah, and while you know the current little cold snap we're going through right now, you know, may make people forget, but you know, heat-related issues for you know, farm workers and you know, anybody who works outdoors, you know, are pretty dire, and it's pretty crazy that you know, Florida government doesn't allow even communities to regulate that. But we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's something you must be looking into based on what you just said.
Yeah, we've been trying to get a state level heat standard passed for years, and we've been able to get sponsors at the legislative level here in the state of Florida. But the proposed legislation that we have supported dies in committee; it's never been brought up for a vote. And what we're calling for is very similar to what OSHA proposed last year in their federal suggested guidelines. And it's common sense; this isn't rocket science. We need to ensure that workers have safety from heat stress. That's pretty easy to achieve. You need to monitor the temperature. You need to monitor their exertion. They need to have access to water. They need to have access to areas in which they can cool down, particularly during critical periods of the year, which in Florida is like June, May, sometimes through October. And it's stuff that we already do for student athletes. There's the Zachary Martin Act passed in the state of Florida, unanimously, after two tragic deaths of student athletes, which tells us that the legislature, the same governor, they understand the science behind this. It's not a complicated issue. What seems to be complicated for some people is to extend the same sort of consideration to certain groups of people over others. In this case, our farm workers, our construction workers, the people who dig our ditches for our high-speed fiber optic cable, so on and so forth. For whatever reason, our state government doesn't seem to prioritize them or value them as they do other groups of people. Again, it's common sense, and it's stuff that's been readily known in physiological science and exercise science, so on and so forth, for decades.
And while those protections are really important, and that's really important work, you know, it seems like, you know, based on what may be coming, you know, they may be moot. You know, the president-elect is made it clear from day one of his term that he intends to deport all illegal immigrants in the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. Of course, Governor DeSantis, he called for a special session, you know, of the legislature, you know, which is not clear when that's going to happen, but he's getting pushback mm-hmm. from them. But the purpose of it was to pass legislation to facilitate that effort in Florida, you know, right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you know, just looking at the federal promise, you know, how do you think that's going to affect your membership? You know. First, tell us a little bit about who your membership is. I believe it's you know, over 90% Hispanic workers, and a lot of them are immigrants. Correct?
Yeah. That's a good breakdown. The vast majority are from Mexico and Central America. However, we have members from the United States, from the Caribbean, from Brazil, from different countries. Basically, anybody who needs help will help. And we started as an organization that responded to the needs of rural farm workers. As you know, the economy has changed in Florida throughout the years. Here in Apopka, where our main office is, there used to be vast oranges, and then through climate change and freezes and different economic transitions, we've been moving away from certain types of production. Now the vast majority of production here in Apopka is ornamental plants, nurseries. All that to say is that we basically are positioned to help rural communities, but we help people in urban areas as well, who are underrepresented, who their rights are being overlooked, who basically standing up for working class people. And that's an important thing to bear in mind when we're talking about immigration, because it's a working class issue. The United States, we have this dire need, and we'll hear this from employers, from farm owners, from contractors. They need the labor. They need the labor, which makes this all the more absurd that we're proposing mass scale deportations when we have population here who has been contributing to our social security, community members, they go to churches, they own businesses, their kids go to school with our kids. And we have on the other side employers who need work, and we're saying, hey, let's deport them because it wins political points. So it'll affect our membership greatly. It already has. There's a lot of worries taking place. We're hosting sessions with lawyers, Know Your Rights workshops. We're collaborating with other allied organizations to see what will happen, what we can anticipate, what recourse we have. And I guess to some extent it's a waiting game. And with Donald Trump, you just don't know. You don't know with him. He is not an ideological person. He has shown us that his interests lie in his pocketbook and in his pocketbook alone. So it's hard to say. It's hard to say whether he believes in something from an ideological standpoint. And the other big question that we have is, this is not good for the farm owners. This is not good for the industry. So to what extent is this all just some sort of dog whistle to rally up the base to get them out to vote? You know, I don't fathom myself clever enough to try to guess what Donald Trump will do. We shall see. But there's good reason to be worried.
Yeah, I have to agree with you because, Donald Trump has, told so many lies and just sort of turned on a dime, claimed one thing very voraciously. And, the fact that, who can ever forget, he's going to build that big, beautiful wall and Mexico is going to pay for it. Well, that never happened. So in essence, you're telling me that, I think that's smart to, sort of sit and wait and sort of be able to react to what might happen. But are people already sort of reacting in a way? I mean, are there some, in the immigrant community, they're saying, man, this is getting a little too hot for me. I got to move to a different hot, not in a literal sense.
Right.
Maybe I got to go try to find work in another state where I might be a little better protected.
It is on the mind of folks, and it's been on the mind of folks for some time, because even before Trump, Ron DeSantis has made it clear that he is anti-immigrant. He's passed legislation which hurts our working communities. So there have been farm workers and rural workers and construction workers who have left the state because of State Bill 1718, for instance. House Bill 433, which came into effect last year, which is the one that prohibits local governments from enacting heat-related protections. So this has been taking place, and Donald Trump is just some sort of catalyst that gets people to wonder more. We're organizing. People are coming together to see what rights are in place, what sort of steps might be taking place, should mass deportations take place. But to a large extent, it's a waiting game. Trying to plan as much as you can, but we don't know. We just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, just actually recently, state AG commissioner. I don't know if you saw this because I think it just came out a couple of days ago or maybe yesterday. Wilton Simpson claimed that deportations will have little effect on Florida since most farms use H-2A visas to legally use foreign labor. Is that true?
I'll have to look at my numbers. It is true that we've been increasingly using H-2A workers, and I believe Florida is the state that uses the highest proportion of H-2A workers. There's no doubt that there's been an upward trend for the last 12 years or so on trying to replace H-2A workers. This idea, though, that somehow will not affect Florida is, in a sense, I think it shows you the framing, the ethical framing, how these people are viewed. These H-2A workers are here sometimes for 10 months at a time. Are we saying that they're not part of Florida? Are they not part of our community members? They're working here. They're paying taxes. They're spending money here. These are community members. They're feeding us. So to casually just say, oh, well, it's not going to affect Florida, well, that's pretty myopic, and it shows you how some people, a lot of them, unfortunately, view workers as just a cog in a machine. Moreover, that program is rife with exploitation, human trafficking, wage theft. We've heard stories in Georgia of people being locked up in sheds, being fed stale bread. We've had Know Your Rights workshops with H-2A workers. When we tell them, hey, this is going to be a discussion about your rights, two of them look at us and say, what do you mean rights? I thought we were slaves. We have people who, the recruiters in Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras, they keep in touch with their families down there so that when they steal their passports here and they steal their wages, if they complain, they say, hey, remember, we know where you live, and remember, we know your daughter, and we know where she is. So this idea that we can just replace our domestic workforce with H-2A workers and nothing bad's going to happen, it is, one, it's objectively wrong, two, it's callous. And three, I would argue from the business perspective, it's incredibly expensive. And you know how big business doesn't like oversight and a government regulation. Well, guess what? H-2A workers entails that. It entails oversight. It entails regulation. They have to feed them. They have to transport them. They have to house them. So it's not an issue that we can just sort of like wash our hands cleanly of.
Yeah, and it's, and it's also important to remember that, at least from the stats that I've seen, almost 100% of farm workers are immigrants, and whether they're documented or not, and by some estimates, two in five are undocumented. So, to find them, what's going to happen to the documented workers? I mean, is there going to be, I keep thinking how this mass deportation is going to work. Are we all going to be required to show our papers?
Yeah, it brings up a whole bunch of questions about civil rights. It's a mess. We shall see. It's not a great situation to be sitting here pondering these scenarios, but unfortunately, that's where we are.
Okay. I just want to interrupt for a second for those just tuning in. This is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV LP FM 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Ernesto Ruiz, Resource Coordinator for Florida, Farm Workers Association of Florida. This is another, I guess, interesting point. I mean, according to things that, Tom Holman, who I guess will be Trump's border czar, the former head, I guess, his former head of ICE, he said some pretty disturbing things. I mean, when he's been questioned about that whole issue of separating families, he said, well, the way we're going to get around that is, if there's an undocumented person in one family, we'll deport the whole bunch of them, and I guess that includes, well, basically what they're talking about is children who maybe have been born in this country who are, in fact, legal citizens of the United States. So, the implication there is going to deport American citizens. I mean, what do we think of that?
Yeah, it's callous. It's absurd. You have to hope that these are just statements thrown out there for sensationalism. Unfortunately, the media news cycle thrives off of extravagant statements of controversy. So it also promotes his profile, right? Because then whatever posts share him are going to get tons of comments. So it's just going to push him up to the top of the algorithm. To what extent does he believe it? Who knows? But the fact that he will utter it, and the fact that we have to sit here and wonder whether or not he actually believes that, whether he thinks that's correct, whether that's the right thing to do, whether it's constitutional, that just shows us some of the struggles that we're up against. And I just like to reiterate just how callous it is. And I wonder, would other people in his position be making these arguments if we were talking about immigrants who weren't of Latin American descent? But I think unfortunately, because we have this sort of noxious combination of anti-immigrant sentiments towards certain immigrants, we have classism where we view poor people as not being worthy of the same consideration. And then when you take these two things together, poor people from the global south, Mexico, Central America, it just becomes, unfortunately, sociologically, it seems to be easier for some people to dismiss them and not grant them the same sort of consideration that they would to somebody who they might view as being, you know, closer to them in ethnicity or in sociological position.
Yeah, you know, as Trump once commented early in his first term that, you know, it'd be great if more people wanted to come here from Norway, but why do they have to come from these, you know, blank hole countries?
Right. Yes.
In Africa.
Yeah.
Norway is a pretty cool place to live.
They have affordable healthcare, and in my experience, I haven't seen Norwegians or Swedes or Danes, for that matter, lining up to work at the farms. It's not happening.
Yeah. You know, and they are social democracies, so you know, everybody kind of gets taken care of. But anyway, I digress. Yeah. You know, and I mean, going back to Tom Holman, the latest thing that I heard, you know, he's floating this idea, you know, of instituting a national tip line. So that's a Texas kind of thing. You know, have your neighbor rat yell, which is another divisive, crazy thing to do.
It is, and it's something that the Chinese Communist Party did. It's something that the Cuban Communist Party has done. It's something that the brown shirts, the black shirts, the Nazis, the fascists did in mid 20th century Europe. I mean, these are tactics of intimidation. These are tactics of pitting people against each other, and it's cruel. It's not conducive to good communal living. It's just absurd. It's absurd and beyond the pale.
Yeah, let's just say at the very least, it's not exactly a unifying type of policy.
No, not at all.
Yeah, you know, and I'll tell you what. You know, I mean, as we already pointed out that DeSantis has established him as a serious himself. Is a serious immigration hawk over the years. What can we expect from him in the Florida legislature now that the feds are planning mass deportation? We're just guessing here, but
we're guessing, right?
Done in the past, but are we gonna mobilize the Florida Guard and law enforcement, you know, to help in this effort?
You know, let me preface this by saying that I'm not a political scientist. I do political analysis as kind of like a necessary part of my job, but that's not how I've been trained. So that qualification aside, I think we can anticipate him trying to try out for his next political phase. You know, his presidential campaign burned in public for all of us to see. So who knows? Is he buying for senator? He's going to try to seize on this opportunity in a way in which benefits him. And ideologically, it's a ripe time for him because he'll have the federal government, the apparatus, the federal discourse aligned with his policy, and he can play that up. He can play it up. He can then align himself again with the Trumpian base. And we shall see, but I think it's fair to say that we're not going to see anything of human concern, anything of worker concern, anything of environmental concern coming out from Ron DeSantis. You know, hopefully he can prove us wrong, and I would love to be proved wrong on this front.
Yeah, you know, I mean, some of the stuff that he's done in the past, though, shows that, you know, like, as you have aptly noted, you know, he's a political animal, you know, and he's looking to make points. I mean, that stunt flying the immigrants from Texas to Martha's Vineyard, you know, who weren't even ever in Florida, or sending the Florida Guard to the border, you know, to join, you know, protecting the border. Because the federal government said, "Oh yeah, putting the big balls of razor wire in the Rio Grande, you know, is maybe perhaps a little too cruel." You know, but you know, and that's another issue too that I keep coming back to when I look at these policies, you know, and what these guys talk about is the whole cruelty aspect of it. You know, that seems to be a big part of it. I mean, we can't just regulate. Yes, it is important to know who's coming in the country. It is important, I guess, to regulate immigration. That's good for everybody. But you don't have to be like mean about it.
So. Yeah, that's a great point, Lou. And I think it highlights the fact that performative cruelty is something that has been institutionalized, and it's been growing. And I think we can. It's easy for all of us, myself included, is to sit here and say, "Oh, these people are horrible." And by these people, I mean the voting base, people who, you know, support Trump, people who support Tom Homan. And that is not the case. That is absolutely not the case. And I think that's important for us to be intellectually honest with each other. The fact that these people can be appealed to, or that groups of people can be appealed to by performative cruelty, that's only possible because people are struggling. They're struggling to pay rent. They're struggling because they don't have health care, because food prices are absurdly, absurdly through the roof, because we live in a society which has legalized corporate corruption, because people don't have their basic needs being met. And so people are terrified. People are terrified. They're stressed. They're sick. Our food system is in shambles. And when you have a population like this, then it's really easy. It's really, really easy to get aggressive populism growing. I believe it was Stalin who once said, communism grows in the cesspools of capitalism. So when people are in harsh economic conditions, when they're stressed out, when they're sick, when they're tired, when they're run down, it's very easy to manipulate them, to appeal to lower bases and get them pit people against each other. But it's important for all of us to remember that the voting base of Democrats, the voting base of independents, of Republicans, by and large in this country, are people who are struggling. By and large are people who just want to feed their families. They just want health care. They want an affordable house. And they just want to make a life. And those basic things, which you would think are the cornerstone of the American dream, are becoming more and more impossible due to the fact that this country is unfortunately a corporate oligarchy. And we have to keep that in mind, and we have to remember that even though there is performative cruelty at the media level, at the policy level, that the vast majority of people in this United States are not cruel. And that gives me hope, and it's something that I see every day.
You know, I couldn't agree more that people are just, you know, people are struggling, and they're just looking to have that problem solved. But, you know, unfortunately, the incoming administration seems to pin all that on immigrants. I mean, if you looked at any press conference, anytime anybody asks the president-elect a question, an economic question about what are you going to do about affordable housing, you know, within like a sentence, it would be, well, we got to stop illegal immigration.
Yeah.
Because that's what's
yeah.
causing housing prices to go up.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You know, food prices, et cetera. You know, well, so anyway, you know, that was all a lie. You know, we're coming down to the end of this, you know, segment, you know, and I really want to thank you, Ernesto Ruiz, for joining me and telling me a little bit about, you know, what's going on, and just very briefly tell our listeners what, you know, FWAF, Farm Workers Association of Florida, you know, is doing, you know, right now to maybe help people. With you indicated earlier, you know, hooking them up with lawyers, I guess, or having some sort of, you know, sessions where they can learn more about their rights.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you so much, Lou, first of all. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. Our organization is trying to connect communities in need with any resources that they have. We start with education. If need be, we can connect them with lawyers, depending on, you know, if it's a labor rights violation, wage theft, so on and so forth. We do a lot of aid. We do food distributions. We collect clothes to hand out to people in need. We have health clinics that we do in partnership with some wonderful organizations, University of Central Florida, among others. We work on policy. We try to, as a grassroots organization, listen to the needs of our community, and then respond to those needs in the way in which we can be as most effective as possible. Right now, a lot of it's focused on immigration, just in the sense of anticipation of what's going to come. But, you know, we work on food sovereignty, community gardens, so on and so forth. And, you know, it's great to have people in the media such as you to take the time and speak with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, once again, thank you, Ernesto Ruiz, for making time for us today. And as this thing unfolds, perhaps we'll speak again.
That would be great. Thank you so much.
Great. Bye-bye.
Apparently, members of law enforcement participated in the Tulsa race massacre. Hard to believe police could have it out for black people. Some law enforcement members participated in arson and murders that occurred during the 1921 race massacre in Tulsa, Oklahoma, according to a U.S. Department of Justice report released last week. The report, which was released in the final days of President Joe Biden's administration, follows decades of advocacy efforts from massacre survivors, descendants, and civil rights groups. Efforts to rebuild a historic community have been underway for years, but advocates have continued to seek justice, including reparations and an official federal review. The DOJ's Civil Rights Division launched the review and evaluation last September into the massacre, where white attackers killed as many as 300 people, mostly black residents living in Tulsa's prosperous Greenwood neighborhood. But despite the gravity of the findings, the DOJ said no avenue of prosecution now exists for crimes that occurred, citing the expiration of relevant statutes of limitations and the youngest potential defendants being more than 115 years old. The report found law enforcement officers, both from the Tulsa Police and the National Guard, disarmed black residents, confiscated their weapons, and detained many in makeshift camps under armed guard. In addition, there are credible reports that at least some law officers did more than arrest and detain black people. Some participated, black men, some participated in murder, arson, and looting, the report said. It pointed to witness testimony. An officer, according to a report, also captured six black men in Greenwood, roped them together in a single file, and then led them running behind his motorcycle to detention at Convention Hall. There is testimony from a white witness who reported seeing officers search black men, reportedly looking for weapons, only to steal money from them and shoot them if they protested, the report said. Another witness called an officer bragging of personally killing four black men, according to the report. The Tulsa City Manager's Tulsa City Mayor's office did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The massacre began after a black man was alleged to have grabbed a white woman by the arm, according to an account. Police arrested the man who was alleged to have assaulted the woman, according to the Justice Department report, which said that a local newspaper sensationalized the story, prompting a mob of white Tulsans to gather outside the courthouse and demand a lynching. A confrontation broke out outside the courthouse where black men from Greenwood and a white mob gathered following the arrest, according to the Justice Department report. Violence erupted after someone fired a shot, it added. Local police deputized hundreds of white residents, many of whom had been advocating for a lynching and had been drinking, the report said. The Tulsa race massacre stands out as a civil rights crime unique in its magnitude, barbarity, racist hostility, and its utter annihilation of a thriving black community, said Assistant Attorney General Christian Clark of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM.